Thanks, everybody, for coming today. It's a real treat to welcome many of you who are old friends back to CSIS to talk about something that is of particular interest and, I hope, relevance as we head into the election and then into the new administration. This is a discussion on a report that we just put out that I hope you all at some point will pick up, if not if you haven't already, called Crafting U.S. Economic Strategy Towards Asia. We started this process about a year ago, I'd say, bringing together different folks from, I think, four administrations, past and present, who had experience looking at structures and processes and policies for engaging with Asia, and in particular looking at China, Japan, and India. And there is a specific apology to those Asian countries that we have not looked at specifically in here, and not so much apology, but an assumption that some of the lessons learned here translate and are useful for relationships with Southeast Asia and Korea in particular, but other parts of Asia as well. This report was crafted at a time when and begun at a time when up was clearly up, down was clearly up, and the laws of physics didn't seem to defy themselves. And I think, you know, Matthew called me as the market was doing another, you know, six-figure double dip the other day, and said, "Is this really the right time to issue this report? Have things changed so radically as a result of the financial crisis and the economic downturn that the rules have to be rewritten all over again?" And my answer is no. I thought the laws of physics still continued to apply and would apply. And frankly, this was exactly the right time to be talking about this because there is a bottom. We don't know where it is exactly, but there is a bottom, and we will hit it, and then we will move forward. And the question of how we move forward is therefore as important as the process of getting our bearings again. And so with that, I think what we wanted to do was look at some of these issues in greater detail. We started really by cataloging the number of bilateral dialogues we had with other countries in particular, and we're kind of astounded at the sheer range and number that we have. And some of these recognize that these are going on within different agencies, and they may be simply bureaucratic exercise aimed at satisfying agency-specific ends. But increasingly, and as the experience of all of us on this task force showed, that the forces of multilateral, bilateral, in this case, economic engagement, tended to swamp, in many cases, the more narrow bureaucratic efforts. So each of us in our experience found that we were pushed, and that the administrations with which we were associated were pushed towards looking at bilateral economic relations from a much broader perspective, whether as a result of political pressures from the Hill, or as a result of larger strategic interests that were not necessarily related to economic issues, but where economic issues played a role, or whether narrow commercial interests, the interests of the business community, really began to push U.S. policy. And so the fundamental thing that we found was that really crisis was driving administration's policy when they looked at economic engagement. You know, whether it's as a result of a bilateral deficit that makes the Hill go nuts and start to put pressure on the administration, or whether there's a narrow issue as why isn't India why is India producing technical standards which are disadvantageous to U.S. firms or otherwise, and it seemed like if there was a problem, it was always the problem that resulted before the new administration had come in, and therefore it was the old administration's problem, and therefore the old administration, whatever they were doing, was inadequate to take to do the task that we were now faced with. So therefore, we threw out whatever the old administration did and began anew. And that's where some of the lessons learned came in. And I want to introduce three very dynamic people, one of whom just got off the plane from Tokyo, so he's going to be perhaps even more dynamic than usual, in Matthew Goodman, who's here with us in his current capacity as a managing director from Stonebridge International, but also was most recently in government as the head of Asian Economic Policy at the NSC. Bill Reinsch, who currently runs the National Foreign Trade Council, but as many of you know, has spent more years. I think he's the 30 years of experience that we've put on the cover here, experience from time in the administration, notably at Commerce, but also in years on the Hill, and Tim Adams, who most of you will recall as one of the real heroes from the U.S. Treasury, and in particular looking at as when he was Undersecretary of International at Treasury. So without further ado, let me turn over to Matthew and talk about the report, and then we're going to ask our two esteemed gentlemen and members of the task force to comment in greater depth. Thank you.
Thank you, Charles. I must say when I saw the attendance list at this event, I had a bit of a Groucho Marx moment because I'm not sure I want to be on a panel that so many people are interested in. And in fact, I hope we're not going to disappoint expectations here, because what we did not do in this report is to lay out in great detail the specific substantive agenda for a new administration with respect to the three countries that we focused on or the rest of Asia generally. This is really a document that is meant to be a kind of user's guide for the new administration on the process of managing economic relations with Asian countries, and in fact, more specifically, the process of managing economic dialogues or bilateral discussions. And I think that there are a lot of groups and people around town who are looking at more substantive matters, and that's great because those are important questions, and all of us, I think, in our own way are involved in some of those discussions, but we wanted to do a sort of narrower thing, which we thought would be kind of useful that maybe others were not looking at, which is the actual process of governing in this area. So what we did was we as Charles said, we started about a year ago, and it sort of took a little longer for us to get everything going as we'd originally hoped. But we basically met probably half a dozen times. And then had inter-meeting conversations and sent around drafts and so forth. And we ended up with this report that you, I hope, all received. And basically it has three sections, the first of which is an introduction and overview that kind of lays out the problem, which is this challenge that any new administration, and incidentally, if Charles didn't say it, this was completely bipartisan effort. We have people from both sides of the aisle, and this guide was not intended for any particular administration. It was for any new administration coming in, but that new administration is going to be faced in reality with challenges in the economic sphere from Asia, and it's going to be important in practice to have mechanisms set up to deal with those issues. And again, there are going to be mechanisms at many levels, but bilateral engagement with at least these three countries is clearly going to be part of any strategy that the new administration is going to face. So we have an introduction overview kind of laying all that out. Then the second section is the lessons learned, and we catalog 14 lessons learned. There's no magic to that number. That's the real number we came up with after we talked this out and decided these were the critical issues as we saw them. And it's divided into four subsections, basically kind of in the chronological order of how these dialogues are set up and implemented, starting with kind of laying the groundwork for this kind of dialogue, looking at past experience, defining the problem, defining the specific negotiating objectives, and so forth. Then the second part is how you organize the U.S. government to deal with these sorts of strategies. And so our most important finding there, or lesson learned, is that the White House role is absolutely critical in this from the beginning and throughout the process, and overseeing and being the kind of enforcer on these dialogues. And then approaching the foreign government is the next subsection, and we have a few lessons learned there about, you know, identifying who you should be talking with, setting expectations with them, and so on. And then finally, a section on communicating with key stakeholders, both here in the United States and in the foreign target country. And then the third and final section is a slightly deeper dive, although not too deep, but a little deeper dive into each of the three countries that we targeted, Japan, or in order, China, Japan, and India. And what we did there was to really look at what the specific lessons learned from engagement in those three countries were, and what we specifically thought needed to be kept in mind as a new administration shaped strategy towards those three countries. And our bottom line conclusions, although, you know, there's more devil in the detail here, but with respect to China, we concluded that both the JCCT and this SED have proven to be useful forums for dialogue with China in their own ways, and they ought to be continued in some form. And even if the agenda is, or the name itself is changed, but the substance of this approach we think is good and should be continued. And then we itemize a few kind of specific challenges that a new administration is going to be faced with in setting out this strategy. With respect to Japan, we bottom line say that the two governments should look at a deeper integration agreement, whether an FTA, an EPA, or even a single market, which nobody, well, you might think is a little bold to talk about right now, but that's that is a reasonable long-term objective between the two countries. We also note that in the short term, the politics is not ready for any of this, that in fact it will take a lot more political factors to fall into place before we could seriously consider any of these possible arrangements with Japan, but that the leaders could set this out as a long-term goal and meanwhile could work on some of the kind of the groundwork for such an agreement. And we lay out specific ideas for that, again, not in great depth, but sort of touch on, I think, the main highlights here. And then with India, again, we talk about the history of growing economic engagement from a very low base with India over the last decade, or, you know, eight or nine years from the end of the Clinton administration through the Bush administration, the development of an economic dialogue originally in the Clinton administration and greatly enhanced in the Bush administration. And again, we conclude that dialogue, the economic dialogue with a capital E and a capital D, is a valuable tool, and that something like that ought to be pursued and continued by a new administration. And then we have a few specific ideas about how to manage India, the most important of which may be to have patience. And the idea, by the way, I guess we didn't say, you didn't use the line that I had used about why we chose these three countries, because we sort of see these three as the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future, Japan being the past, China being the present, and India the future. And they sort of fit in some sense into that schema, but they all have a lot of relevant lessons that you can draw from our experience with those countries, and they do apply not only to those three countries, but to all the other countries of the region, or actually arguably the rest of the world, although there are some unique things about Asia that we do flesh out here or try to. And then finally, we have appendices, which may be the most useful part of the report, which is two very hardworking interns here at CSAS went back and tried to dig out some of the past and present dialogues that we've had with China, Japan, and India, respectively, and those are cataloged. This is by no means an exhaustive list for any of the countries, but it gives you some flavor of how much we are doing and have done with these three countries. We'd welcome, actually, further input, you know, if we ever do an addendum or an update to this report, because I'm sure there's a lot more that some of you, many of you in this room, have been involved with. So that's basically the report. And I would simply say, Bert, there are places up front if you want. Nobody ever likes to sit up front, but there is actually space. Yeah, except Chris. So that's what the report has. You know, hopefully it's short enough that you can skim through it pretty quickly and get a sense of it. This is really intended as a kind of user's guide or a practical guide to how to manage these issues and how to set up and manage these dialogues. I think we have all found through our collective experience that that there's a sort of an eagerness in a new administration to come in and do something new and different. And if you find out that actually many of these things, that there really is nothing new under the sun. Most of these issues have been dealt with in one form or another before. And if you draw on some of the lessons from what's been done before, you can actually find that you don't need to reinvent the wheel, that you can create, you can build new mechanisms on what's gone before and have a very effective strategy with these countries. So that's basically it. I'm happy to say more on the questions and answers if you have specific questions, but let me turn it over to Bill, I guess, is next in line, or Tim, whoever wants to go next.
Well, that last comment reminds me a little bit of the American, I don't know what he was, politician in 1896 who announced that we might as well close the patent office because everything that could possibly be invented had already been invented and we didn't need to do any more. There may be new things under the sun. I'm not sure that we've identified them in this report, but I don't lose heart. I'd like to make a couple random comments on it, but I hope we can save most of the time for discussion. This was an enormously fun thing to participate in, partly because we all got to tell stories, which you don't always get to do when you're doing this. But it really is about what worked and what didn't work over the past almost 30 years of trying to deal with complex economic situations, many of which have changed, pretty much stayed the same over the 30 years, although the methods of dealing with them haven't always been exactly the same. And probably the biggest lessons learned are one that Matt just said, patience, the other being to have realistic expectations. The problem is that these processes that the piece discusses have been trying to deal with, the problems have been around for a long time, and the best we seem to be able to do is tweaking at the margins. That doesn't mean you don't try to do better, or you don't set out to do better, but it does mean that you have to be realistic about the likely outcome. That said, I think this is a really important study, particularly for all of those of you that intend to get jobs in the next administration. You ought to read this because it's an important primer, really, on how to go about trying to approach complex problems in the region in ways that are designed or at least will enable you to maximize your success. And in this particular case, that is in the case of Asia and these three countries in particular, this is really important. It's important practically because we have very large bilateral deficits with two of them that have been sustained over a long period of time that has ripple effects, as you all know, in our economy that I don't need to go into. It's an important policy issue because both of those countries, China and Japan, essentially have been practicing export-led growth instead of pursuing policies intended to increase domestic consumption. As a result, their success in doing that has an enormous effect on us, not only in terms of the bilateral base, the trade deficit, but on our manufacturing base, jobs, and a wide variety of other things. It's also important politically, as the report acknowledges, because one of the things that every administration finds has to deal with is to respond to and or diffuse congressional sentiments for dealing with these problems in more arbitrary ways and dealing with them through legislation, which is generally the sledgehammer approach as opposed to the scalpel approach and might be appropriate in some circumstances, but more often than not has not been. Congress doesn't have a lot of tools to deal with foreign economic policy. That doesn't make them very happy, so they attempt to use the tools they've got, which tend to be fairly heavy-handed. So sometimes what we learned was that administrations have to deal with these problems whether they want to deal with them or not, because if they don't deal with them, there will be other remedies coming from the Congress that will create political and legislative problems. Now, I think the document provides a lot of practical lessons as to how to proceed, and you've just heard an explication of them. I want to highlight just a couple of them and organize them in a slightly different fashion. The first, and in many respects, I think the most important, which Matt repeated a couple times, is don't reinvent the wheel. What we discovered was that not everything the preceding administration did was stupid, and that a lot of stuff deserves to be, even if it's repackaged, it deserves to be continued, the continuity maintained. As a side note, not in the study, there's an enormous advantage to this in political terms, and that is if you continue a program, you can blame your predecessor if it fails, and you never want to be without that alternative as a good administration bureaucrat. I discovered when I was at Commerce doing export controls, I quickly realized that there's this enormous data lag in that particular corner of the world, and so that every scandal that developed always developed about 2 years after it occurred. So for the first 2 years, I could blame everything on the people that went before me. And, of course, the secret then is to get out in time, which is a mistake that I made of staying in. Eventually things catch up with you. But there are advantages to not simply, I think as he put it, throwing out the baby with the bathwater. There are good ideas, and there are successes that each of the previous three administrations have had, and the goal of the next administration ought to build on those rather than to ignore them. Another group of lessons focuses on clearly defining the problem and the goals. The old cliche, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there, and we discovered that from time to time. One of the difficulties for administration sometimes is trying to undertake an effort which is overt, which is covertly, if you will, or in actuality political, that is to try to deal with Congress, and you don't have any real expectation of accomplishing anything, yet you can't stand up and say that and say we're only engaging in this dialogue with you. We don't expect to accomplish anything in this dialogue. We're only doing it to keep people quiet. In fact, that may be the answer, but nevertheless, there has to be a veneer, however thin, of actual policy intent behind it. Balancing those different objectives is and being honest with oneself is an important challenge for administrations, and those that go into it without having answered those questions, at least quietly and internally, end up being less successful. The third group of lessons is about preparation, which is very important, I think, to the extent that the report is comments, particularly on the SED, was it's probably an enterprise which I think was a very important one, is a very important one, and I hope will be continued. I think it had a rocky beginning, and in part because of preparation. You need to define agency roles clearly. You need to define who is in charge clearly. You have to have, as I think Chaz said, somebody in the White House who's in charge of coordination and oversight, and somebody who is clearly there regularly saying, this is something the president cares about, it's something that needs to be brought to a conclusion in order to avoid the normal interagency gridlock. And you need to prepare by preempting possible opposition through consultations, which means you have to spend a lot more time on the Hill than anybody in the executive branch wants to spend. The report makes clear that the classic and in part constitutional dilemma between the two branches of government, the administration, the Congress thinks consultation is the president coming up saying, I don't know what to do, tell me what to do. The administration thinks consultation is we give you 2 hours advance notice on the press release. Somewhere in between the two, there's a happy or unhappy medium. But any good administration knows how to consult, knows can identify early on who the actors are in the Congress that matter on this subject, and go up and brief them and fold them into the process in some constructive way. They don't have to agree with you, but they have to be a part of the process so they don't destroy you as things go on through the well-timed leak or the sneak attack. You know, 2 days before a critical meeting, you've got somebody in Congress announcing that no matter what you come out with, it's unacceptable. That's not a good way to go into a meeting, and it's all avoidable. The other element of consultation, of course, is with the public, with business, with labor, with other interest groups. There are established procedures for doing that, and the report, I think, has some useful lessons as to how to tap into those established procedures and also how to, if necessary, work around them. The final group, develop a tactical plan for dealing with the other country, figure out what level they're approaching the problem at, and figure out how to match their level, or figure out what level you want to use because you know they're going to match your level. So figure out where this should be hierarchically because you know what their response, you can predict their response, particularly in China and Japan. Figure out how to explain what you want in terms of what's good for them, which is one of the things that I think the SED talks did very effectively with the Chinese, was not to come in explaining why we want them to do something for the United States, which would always be a non-starter with the Chinese. Instead, tell the Chinese why there's some things they could do that would be good for them, which, by the way, would also be good for us and the global economy. That is a far more saleable argument, and generally speaking, the arguments that we pursue can be made on that basis, but you need to develop the arguments. And finally, don't negotiate in the public and don't negotiate in the media. Negotiations are for the behind closed doors. The longer I've been in this business, the less I've become a fan of sunshine, which we can go into in Q&A if anybody cares. I'm not going to comment on the specific policy initiatives. We can go into that later, too. I would just make a couple points. One, China and Japan are not the same, and the Wise administration won't treat them the same. It's enormously tempting to define the economic problem as the same, and it isn't. Most of you in this audience know that, but a lot of people outside this audience and people in Congress don't see it that way. I think it's important sometimes for the administration to be a teacher on some of this stuff and to articulate a more nuanced view of some of these issues than might be, certainly than you get on Lou Dobbs and other media venues. The other thing, circling back to where I began, if you look at our policy with respect to all of these countries, less India than the other two, for the last 30 years, they've tended to operate within a fairly narrow band. If you think of policy as being on a 10-point scale, we tend to operate between 4 and 6. There are flights of rhetoric that go way beyond that, and that's fine, particularly during campaign cycles. You see flights of rhetoric, and incumbents are invariably blamed as being for being soft on whoever the target of the moment is, Japan earlier, China now. It'll be India in the future. I can guarantee you we'll go through the same cycle. That's fine. When governments get in, they discover that the nature of the relationship in all three of these countries' cases is so large and so broad and so important that one needs to tread very carefully. And that ends up, I think, having administrations pursue policies that are, you know, relatively minor variations from each other, and that's probably the best way to go about it. But that brings me then to the final point, which is to lower expectations. As long as you're operating within a narrow band and as long as you're dealing with the intractability of the problems that we all know about, to expect solutions, particularly in short time frames, is simply unrealistic. One of the mistakes that some past administrations made, I feel, has been to assume that coming in they could simply solve the problems that eluded their predecessor. And one of the things we've learned, particularly with Japan, from long and painful experience, is that these problems are not easy to solve. And you can expend enormous time, energy, and resources and come up with a very small improvement at the margin, which then you have to watch constantly to make sure it's mutually implemented. That's not a suggestion that we shouldn't undertake these efforts. We should. They're all meritorious, but more that we should be realistic in doing so, and particularly not raise expectations outside the process, either in Congress or in the public, that turn out to be unrealistic. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. First, I applaud Matt and Charles for their leadership on this report. We had some great conversations. I think it's timely and is chock full of great lessons. And I wish that we had had this when we were running transition back in 2001 and in previous positions. Fortunately, we were in my previous position. I was blessed with great career staff who'd lived through many of these previous forums and brought enormous experience and wisdom to the table. And then we had just great leadership out of the NSC and some of the people in the audience here today. And I want to recognize them for that and thank them. I want to step back a moment, and before I'll echo some of the things that Bill said, but just to emphasize something that I think you said, Charles, when you started out, is this relevant today given all that's going on in the world? Absolutely. You know, this global financial crisis, which we're in the midst of, and who knows in what way it twists and turns, or how the plot thickens. It's a reminder of the changing nature of the balance of power. And I noted a Sydney newspaper a week ago yesterday that said, headline was, "The End of the U.S. Era, China Now Plays the Tune." And I think there is a growing belief that this is part of, if not an acceleration of, a diminution of U.S. power and greater multipolarity in the world. The question is whether we'll have multilateralism with that multipolarity. And that brings us to the summit that will occur in about 2 weeks, I guess. And the issue of whether we're going to rewrite the global architecture and whether there'll be a Bretton Woods III system. And that's important because the Bretton Woods II system was very important to this bilateral relationship. In fact, it was the U.S.-China relationship was in a sense a cornerstone to the Bretton Woods II, and in some ways was, and we can certainly get into this in Q's and A's, probably helped facilitate the disequilibriums that existed. We used to think they were stable disequilibrium. We found out that's not true, but gave rise to and facilitated the enormous disequilibriums that existed, which we're now unwinding. But as we go into this summit, China and U.S. together will play an important role, basically because we've been the two great engines of economic growth over the past 5 years. But and it's one of the most important economic relationships in the world. But we just saw out of the weekend summit, the EU-China summit, how important this is to Asia and is important to China. I hope that we see leadership out of China, and I hope we see leadership out of Japan. I think it's important as they play a greater role in economic activity and in capital flows, that they also play a greater role in crafting the decision-making apparatus for the future. And that's everything from what a Bretton Woods III system looks like, and the role of the IMF and other yet-to-be-developed institutions. But multilateralism doesn't preclude stronger bilateral relations, and we certainly need it. If you think about the issues that we together confront, and again back to China, we're the two largest consumers of coal, the two largest consumers of oil, and the two largest emitters of greenhouse gases. And if you think about the spillover effects of all three of those trends and multiple other similar trends, how we work together has enormous implications for our friends and neighbors in other places. So it's incumbent on us to find ways to work together and solve what appears to be bilateral challenges, but in fact they are global. And those things range from the energy issues, which I mentioned, to how we're going to do development assistance, to actually how we're going to address many of the emerging market countries which are finding themselves in facing their own financial challenges, showing up at the fund looking for financial assistance, but some looking for bilateral assistance and maybe even trying to play one of us off the other. Getting to the specifics of the report, and I think Bill did an excellent job of looking at and reviewing the various pieces. The two that I just wanted to emphasize that he talked about, but again emphasize, is the issue of the time horizon and how you manage the need for deliverables at every time you get together versus the complexity and of the problems and the need to spend what may be years working through their origins, their interactions, but also their solutions. But every time you meet, there is this hunger for what have you achieved, what have you achieved? And some of that is driven by the media. Some of it is driven by Congress in responding to their needs, private entities and other stakeholders. But there goes the second part, which Bill raised, which is that creating the right set of expectations. And, you know, no one wants to launch something new or give it a different twist and then say, oh, by the way, it's going to take years for it to have any effect. You know, this town doesn't run on that kind of time horizon. And so if I could give any advice to the next administration as they think about these various current entities, these institutions, and I hope certainly with China that they decide to keep the SED and the JEC and the JCCT, that they think about how they set expectations from the very beginning and manage those expectations so that every time that there's a meeting, there isn't this rush to what did you achieve today? Because the idea of achieving long-term, important, critical solutions are often swamped by the need to put out a fact sheet that often is, and I've written them, that sometimes lapses into platitudes and principles rather than something that's meaningful. But again, driven by this desire and this need that you've got to feed the beast, you've got to put out something that looks like you're making progress and justifying the plane tickets and the time that you're spending and responding to the outside political pressures. And with respect to the China relationship, they were enormous. They were enormous because there was a view in the country that manifests itself through Congress and other political opinion makers that somehow the relationship was inequitable for the U.S. and that somehow the U.S. workers were paying the price of that inequity. And I'll tell you, I was on the other end of the speed dial from a number of members of Congress and their staff asking almost daily, what have you done today to change this relationship? And we didn't create this equilibrium overnight, and it's not going to be solved overnight, but there is this desire and this need to find short-term solutions. So my advice is set the right set of expectations going into the next administration with a big dose of reality as to what you can actually achieve. Certainly be energetic in your efforts to achieve those objectives. But set expectations with your counterparts, with the media, with Congress, with the private sector, and then try to focus on what's real and not try to get caught up in the we've got to produce a fact sheet by tomorrow morning. Let's just pull something off the shelf. Why don't I stop there? We'll go into the Q's and A's.
Well, that was very good. And I want to just before we get to Q&A, I want to emphasize, you know, whoever comes in their new administration, I think it's almost inevitable that you come in and you inherit this great power in the administration, and therefore that you believe that gives you some leverage, or you believe that entitles you to a certain amount of leverage with whatever country you're dealing with. And so therefore the approach tends to be, at least at first blush, and I know we're in an era of great humility, but even with that humility, I think that the temptation will be to say, well, we're the world's only superpower, and therefore that gives a certain amount of leverage to us. And as if, you know, we're the king and you have to do what we say or else we can't be king anymore. And there's also this notion that, you know, we're the world's largest customer, and we're your largest customer. So as your largest customer, that gives us, because the customer is always right, a certain amount of leverage. Or finally, a sense that, well, I personally will be able to have a greater influence because of I'm going to speak softer or more nicely or somehow. The reality is there is not as much leverage as we hope there to be. And that gets to, I think, the thing that each one of the panelists have said here, and that's patience. So how you draft all the stakeholders into this town into something that gets behind some notion that patience is required is, I think, the job. I think Father Guido Sarducci, I don't know if you remember, he had this wonderful thing where this bit where he said, I'll give you the university in three steps. Economics, all you need to know, supply and demand. With respect to philosophy, God is everywhere. With this one, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater, and patience. So, questions?
Yeah, Irv Chapman, I work for Bloomberg Radio. To be useful to people outside this room and those who didn't come with a resume for the U.S. Trade Representative, could you get into some of the weeds? You suggested a free trade deal with Japan, but getting one with Korea has proved an enormous set of obstacles, including autos and beef, which in fact were obstacles with Japan before. There's been a suggestion that the issues between us and Japan are not reflected in the issues with us and China, but if you look back at the issues when Japan was riding high, they seem to be quite the same issues. We're going through an election campaign in which the promise is we're going to stop the export of American jobs somehow, and yet we've just heard that we have absolutely no leverage to do anything we want to be, that we have to consult with labor unions, who are in fact the most protectionist element in the body politic, and that we have to persuade U.S. workers that they're not getting the short end of the stick or the equity. But they are, aren't they?
No. Next question. No, I mean, in terms of getting into the weeds, I mean, we really are – one of the earliest debates we had with respect to this this piece was whether or not we wanted to come up with very, with serious policy prescriptions that we would pass to the next administration. And we ultimately decided not to, in large part because we knew they'd be ignored. Anybody who wants to come in is going to have their own policy prescriptions that they want to put forward. The point really of this, and we, you know, we all hate process, but this is a process document. This is designed to help the next administration, as they begin to input their own policy prescriptions, figure out the best means of achieving those in ways that are effective, not just with the body politic here, but with counterparts. We can have a long discussion about the utility of these relationships for the American worker or not. That may take more time than we have here. I'm happy to let Bill and Tim duke it out in the hallway for your amusement if you'd like later. But I don't know if anybody has specific comments on that they can keep to a couple minutes.
I just make one point, that one thing you said sort of caught my interest. I believe in consultation with everybody. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with consulting with labor or business. They're all citizens. They're all Americans. They all deserve to have their voice heard. I don't think there's any reason why we shouldn't consult with everybody. I mean, the government's job is to I think the president's job is to try to lead public opinion as best he can and be a teacher. But the people need to be heard, and I think labor unions deserve to be heard as much as anybody else. And it's a practical matter. If you don't do that, then they find a way to bite you, which is true of the business community as well. It's good politics, not to mention good government.
Bert Keitel at the Carnegie Endowment. It's wonderful to see all of you up here. It's an incredible tranche of experience. I wanted to go to something that Tim was talking about, which is time horizon and deliverables, and I'm going to talk about China and the long-term likely economic success of China, scale that it could accomplish, and how that doesn't seem to be on the radar screen of the commercial folks, just in terms of meeting and then doubling the size of the American economy by the middle of this century, and the kind of changes that's going to take in the posture that America will be able or required to take when we're no longer the biggest economy in the world. How do you break that down into shorter-term steps? And that seems to be a kind of a process problem where you see something that's too far out for this town, but it's very important. And we may be headed in a way, if you climb a mountain with your eyes before you take off, you're likely to have a better chance of reaching the top. So if we want to get there, and that's not going to work, and this isn't going to work, and this isn't going to work, but we could go here and then double back over here and get here and somehow make it as a. And I like that juxtaposition of multilateral as opposed to multipolarity. What experience do we have in achieving really some long-term adjustments that may not be particularly popular on their face or even seeming realistic to most of the important actors, including those that have doctrines about space-based platforms and things? That are also feed into our own commercial life. What experience do we have for finding steps that actually make it to the top of the mountain instead of ending up at a cliff somewhere?
It's a great question, and certainly one of the great China hands, and actually we traveled together to China a number of times when he was in government. You know, I think what you do is you broaden your agenda, and from there you'll find pieces of that agenda which you can make some progress on. So the treasurer, the SED, was not just about financial. It was about everything from as broad as changing the composition of growth in China from investment and exports, but it's mainly investment, to more consumption-based. That's a big thing, right? And that's a half a century process. And finding good data and trying to show that on a quarterly or monthly basis, incredibly difficult. But you can take another big issue, which I mentioned, which is climate change and energy consumption, and being both the largest consumers, again, of coal and of oil. And we can at least show that we've done some commercial transaction, which brings nuclear energy into China, and hopefully into the U.S. as well. And we can back out of that what that nuclear energy as a replacement for coal-burning energy would mean with respect to greenhouse gas emissions. And so there are some short-term ways or medium-term ways, and I applaud Treasury and others for taking on the energy environment piece because I think it's very critical. There are ways to get beyond just your narrow lane and look for examples in which, yes, it's a long-term objective, but there are some ways that we can look at. Granted, they're inputs rather than outputs, but there are ways which we can show some progress and some confidence-building measures. But there's also some near-term changes. One of the objectives we advocated for was in opening up the financial service sector, which I suspect is probably not going to happen now, or certainly not happen at the pace in which was advocated. But that was much easier to show tangible. The word tangible and deliverables always seem to pop up. It was much easier to show tangible regulatory change. Now, for any country, whether they actually were implemented remains to be seen. It's easy to change laws or change regs on the books, but the actual practice is sometimes a different story. That was much easier to show because you could come back and say, see what XYZ country, not just China, has agreed to do over the medium term with respect to changes in laws. It goes back to defining what the problem is, and I think that's discussed in this paper. Appropriate, how you define the problem leads you to certain solutions. And I think you have to be very smart in how you define the problem and, again, set expectations about what you can possibly hope to do, and then that you can actually measure what it is you hope to do. And that's again, just setting this thing up the right way from the very beginning.
I guess I have two reactions. One, if you look at the big picture, it's pretty intimidating and depressing. I would worry a little bit that if you try to deal with it that way, it's going to be very discouraging. I think it's more productive to do, in a sense, what Tim suggested, which is to break a problem into pieces and try to deal with it a piece at a time. As from a government perspective, you don't want to lose sight of the whole, but I'm not sure you can tackle it that way. I think you're better off tackling it the way you suggested it. But the other element I'd comment on is that if your focus is on sort of relative economic strength, for lack of a broad term that covers a lot of things, I'm inclined to think that a lot of the remedies, or a lot of the things that one could do about that from an American point of view, don't lie in the realm of trade policy, and they don't lie in the realm of diplomacy, because there are things that we need to do for ourselves on education policy, on R&D, on adjustment, and a whole host of things like that. I've always felt that if the issue is how do we stay ahead of the other guy, whatever that means, there's only two ways to do that. You either run faster or you hold them back. And holding them, whoever they are, back doesn't work very well for a lot of reasons in virtually every way you can try it, particularly in the kind of economy that we've got now. So the solution is you run faster, and there's a whole set of policy prescriptions that one can supply for what does that mean and how do you do that. The nice thing about them is most of them don't involve negotiating with the Chinese or the Japanese. They involve things that we can do here ourselves in terms of changing domestic policies. That, of course, puts them outside the purview of this, but I think that's really the answer to the dilemma that you're posing.
I'm going to go to Chris and then Ernie.
Thanks. I wanted to ask a question I asked last week. The same room about the upcoming G20. I may have misunderstood something that Tim was saying. but I think it fits in the sense of expectations and agendas and what you want. I asked last week what the optics of the November 15th, 4-hour G20 were going to be, and were there important things that we should expect from it, and who should participate and all that. And the answer I got was, I think the same Saturday Night Live you were watching, only I didn't get the Guido Carducci. I got Dan Arkwright saying, gee, Chris, what a stupid question. I can't believe you're so naive to ask a stupid question like that. I think maybe, is certainly true more often than not, perhaps. But on this one, I sense perhaps you would see it a little differently, that you know, given the world crisis that we're in, that there is a leadership role, and optics do matter. And I'm wondering if you could take a crack at what we might expect on the 15th. It wouldn't be just naive and stupid. That would give us some guidance. Thank you.
I worry about an expectations gap for the 15th, and that's not necessarily originating from the U.S. But I think there are a lot of people kind of running around the world saying we're going to put in place a new financial architecture. And I think Barry Eichengreen said after the Asia financial crisis, we don't need a new architecture, we just need a plumber. And I think, again, it goes back to defining what's the problem we're trying to solve. And I worry that some are out there signaling that somehow we're going to create this new architecture, and I don't think you can do that in a summit with 100 people in a room in 2 weeks from now. I think what you can do is find some tangible deliverables which are well known, which are on the shelf, which entities like the Financial Stability Forum, Mario Draghi and others have put on the table, and I think there's a lot of great ideas that are kicking around about how to make the regulatory process more counter-cyclical than pro-cyclical. But I would think of this as the beginning of a process, and maybe a lengthy process. And then in a process which it's still not defined who is going to, what institutional arrangement is going to be leading this process. Is it going to be the G20? Is it the IMF? Is it the G7, which I think is outdated and needs to be expanded? Is it some other new group that we have yet to create? So some of it is setting the right expectations, deciding what the problem is and the scope of the solutions, beginning a process, and then trying to figure out who's going to get us there. And, of course, all this is occurring with the backdrop of U.S. elections, so we're not even sure what the next president's going to want to do. But I would hope that there is strong U.S. leadership. I think without strong U.S. leadership, it will be very difficult to do much of anything, and I would urge the next administration to take this issue seriously, this issue of this architecture in this crisis, and immediately after the election begin thinking about where they want to take this effort.
I think everything Tim said is absolutely right. One way to look at the meeting on the 15th is, if it is 4 hours, that's 240 minutes. There are 20 countries around the table, so that's 12 minutes per country. It doesn't suggest that there's going to be a lot of time to do anything more than clear throats in that amount of time. And so there is a risk of sort of deflated expectations. I mean, I would say in defense of this event, this is more a sort of crisis management type of event rather than sort of necessarily something that there was time to kind of think through and develop a concrete agenda for. And I think you have to look at it, as Tim said, as part of a long-term process. But certainly these issues are extremely important, and I think they're going to be a central strategic question for the next administration. They're going to have to think long and hard about these issues and work on trying to refine that agenda and the meeting schedule, even, and the participants in the meeting, so that you get meaningful results out of it. This meeting in an ideal world would have been more thought through and would have had a sharper agenda. But you know, we are in a kind of crisis management phase, and there is a sort of a need and imperative to show that countries are taking this seriously and trying to respond effectively.
If I might add, if we just reaffirm the ideals of the first Bretton Woods in the conference, the ideals of the importance of economic interaction and a set of multilateral institutions that governs that interaction. If we can reaffirm our support for these institutions and remind ourselves why protectionism and beggar-than-neighbor policies not only don't work but could be incredibly disastrous for the global economy, if we do nothing other than that to launch this process, that's pretty important. A reminder of what do we believe in? What are our values? Why did we set these institutions up in the first place in the shadow of the Second World War? If we can do that, that's a good place to start, because I'm not sure there's even common agreement on that. But reaffirming our values in the institutions, I think, is a pretty good place to start.
Thank you. Ernie Prieg, Manufacturers Alliance. In terms of interagency policy coordination and high-level dialogue with key countries, I want to raise the issue of this, the linkage between exchange rate and trade policies. It's been around many years. It goes to the heart of Bill Reinsch's point about a problem we have with China in particular and Japan is export-led growth, trade surpluses rather than balanced growth. In terms of lessons learned, actually this is the third time around. The first time, you didn't get into it, but I was in the earlier too. It was in the summer of 71 with the Europeans, and they had their rates pegged low. Their reserves were going way up. Our trade deficit was going up. In the U.S. government, there was high-level interagency coordination. Treasury lead, but it was strong. John Connolly, but his lanky young undersecretary, Paul Volcker, was key person. But Henry Kissinger in the White House, U.S. trade representative, it was. And there was a lot of dialogue, and I was involved in the dialogue with the Europeans coming up 70, 71, and then finally there was the showdown, and it was resolved. The second time you do refer to in the paper was in the early mid-80s with Japan and Europe up the Plaza Accord. A lot of dialogue, and in fact, you do cite in the paper, there was a sub-cabinet yen-dollar working group in 83, 84, similarly with the Europeans, and then finally Plaza Accord, which was intensive dialogue leading up to that accord. And yet, in this most recent and the most important of the three, with China and the currency manipulation, to use the IMF term, I haven't seen interagency coordination. Treasury is in charge and sort of doesn't see the problem much, whereas whenever I've been talking to USTR, Commerce, or other people around town, and on the Hill, because we were in very close consultation on the Hill in those early two, less. And then in the paper, one last citation, when you get to China on page 27, the JCCT has 18 working groups, all on specific issues. There are 12, in addition, sub-cabinet dialogues on issues. And nowhere in there is exchange rate measure. There's no yuan-dollar working group or even any mention of this issue. So my question is, did you get into this at all? Is the interagency coordination, is the high-level dialogue with China, has it been adequate? Is it a problem, in effect, looking ahead?
There's a lot of dissertations that could be written out of just that question. Just looking historically, and I don't mean to be flip about this, but the world was a lot simpler in 1971. You know, the IMF was composed of 35 countries, and really only a handful of them mattered. The Plaza Accord was a G5, and they probably composed 80% of global growth. And it was, and the world's different now. As I noted, power, economic power, and political power is more diffuse, and there are more actors, and we have different systems, and we've come from different places, and we don't necessarily have the same overlapping set of near-term objectives. So it's much more complex than it has been in the past. Not to take anything away from what was done in those periods of time. They were important at the time, but I think it's a more complex process, too, is that exchange rates were always a part of our discussions with the Chinese, with the Japanese, with a lot of places around the world. I spent a lot of time on airplanes and on telephones with the major economic actors in the world talking about both short-term and medium-term movements, but also what are the rules of the game in which we should all be guided? And I think the Treasury was instrumental in bringing about changes at the IMF to put in place a new set of guidelines and re-energize the fund's role in looking at what is considered to be misaligned exchange rates and what should be the appropriate rules of the road going forward. The U.S. can't do that by itself, and we need the – and it goes back to the question I said earlier. It's important for the economic powers of the world to reaffirm their support for the institutions and task them and give them the authority to do what we all think is important, and the role of the fund and the bank and others. And let the fund and bank do what they're supposed to be doing, and exchange rates is an important part of that. But the exchange rate is just a piece of the relationship. It is the disequilibrium that existed is a reflection of larger disequilibrium that exists. Quite frankly, we spend too much and don't save enough here, and they have enormous excess savings, and they exported that savings to us. You know, as Greenspan said, they make and we take. And but that's true with a lot of places, and we now know that process, the so-called Bretton Woods II process, and the disequilibrium that existed, was much more precarious than we thought before. But that again should lead us to reaffirm our support for the fund and these other institutions, and if it's not the G7, then the G12. But we shouldn't say because they didn't work that somehow, or they didn't work as well as they should, somehow it wasn't taken on. It certainly was. It was an active part of our interactions.
I'd just add to that. I mean, there are at least six people in this room, three of them on this panel, who spent, an inordinate amount of time over the past 6 or 7 years working on exchange rate issues or exchange systems with China as part of an overall integrated China economic discussion, and that was I thought extremely well coordinated, well thought out, thoroughly vetted, and led to specific interactions. I mean, because one agency naturally has a lead on an issue doesn't mean that they aren't coordinating behind the scenes with a range of other issues, and I think that was true in both the U.S. and Chinese sides. But there was extensive discussion interagency, and I think that was reflected. Those discussions ended up shaping a strategy which ended up being quite actively pursued vis-a-vis China, and frankly quite effectively in the scheme of things. I mean, there are things you can criticize about it, but I'll tell you, the wolf was scraping at the door when I was at the NSC on this issue, and as I say, the six people that I'm thinking of in this room involved with that, helped in a coordinated manner to try and keep that wolf from the door.
Hi, Jim Lister, Korea Economic Institute. I wonder if the panelists see any scope for a trilateral or quadrilateral meeting to both to supplement the bilateral and also to perhaps help foment some ideas for broader multilateral groups.
There's always room for more, and that's generally the problem. If you get into a trilateral, it quickly becomes a demand for a quadrilateral, and then Australia comes knocking, and then who are you excluding? It becomes very difficult to break off and establish new subgroups of APEC or otherwise. But I do think there are room for occasional and issue specific discussions among multiple parties. Not everybody plays ball with that. China doesn't really like the idea of quadrilaterals or trilaterals. They prefer bilaterals. So you're somewhat limited by who your counterparty is. But that said, from a U.S. standpoint, there are times when, yes, it makes an awful lot of sense to have Japan in the room with China, to have Europe in the room with China, to have China in the room with India, and China, Russia, Japan, and South Korea in the room with North Korea.
From the Voice of America's China branch, in the report. But first of all, thank you for putting the report together. It's very practical and informative. In the part that deals with China, in the very last paragraph, at one point it says, and I'm quoting verbatim, in some cases, brinksmanship is the only way to achieve meaningful progress on tough issues with China. I'm just wondering if any one of the panelists could give us some examples on what some of those scenarios might be. And secondly, all the panelists talk about lowering expectations when it comes to dealing with China. I'm just wondering if, again, you can give some specific examples of how and where these expectations might be lowered. And thirdly, you all talked about the importance of not throwing out the baby with the bathwater. In your views, again, it goes to all of you, what are some of the specific tangible achievements made by the current administration that perhaps shouldn't be reinvented with the coming administration? Thank you very much.
Let me answer the brinksmanship question. There have been times in – first of all, it always is important to understand your leverage, to understand what the other party really wants out of a negotiation, if they're at, or a discussion, a dialogue. If they're in the room with you, there's a chance that they want something. It's really important to understand what that thing is and what you're willing to do to give up – to them to get it. We tend to think in these terms of it being a one-way street where we're demanding something from the other party and not really willing to give up something ourselves. We're always willing to give up something. We're always willing to do something for the other side. And the question is what, you know, how much are we really willing to give up? There have been times when it's thoroughly appropriate to throw down the book, and jump in a cab and head to the airport and say, we're not getting what we want. Frequently, that's enough to get the other side back to the table because they don't want to see something erupt in chaos. And if they do, chances are you overestimated what they wanted to begin with. But brinksmanship is always appropriate. I mean, there's always a process of probing in a dialogue or a negotiation. Charlene Bershevsky would not have been able to deliver the agreement that she delivered without a significant degree of brinksmanship, for example.
On the baby and bathwater question, part of your question, I mean, I've already cited a couple of the things that we think the Bush administration's done right and just talked about, you know, foreign exchange policy and the SED itself. I mean, we say in the report that we think the SED has been a useful addition to the U.S.-China sort of armory of tools to manage the relationship, and we think broadly, although you know we note that it did have a bit of a rocky start at the beginning, partly because of failure to manage expectations appropriately and sort of think through all the details up front. But once it was established and up and running, it's proven to be actually quite an effective forum for dialogue to talk about the long-term issues that Bert cited, that you know, but with some short-term payoff to prove its relevance. So I actually think, on balance, I think this administration has made. Of course, I would say this because I was involved in doing this. But I think, given the stresses in the system, I actually think that this administration has managed Asian economic issues pretty well, on the whole.
I'm probably the worst person in the room to talk about the successes of the current administration. So I'll defer to others about that, except to say one thing, which is I already said something kind about the SED, so I won't repeat that. I would put a vote in, too, I think, for the quiet success of the JCCT in a couple respects. I was thinking, as Tim was talking earlier about deliverables, it shouldn't always be about deliverables, but deliverables are important. They're important to sustain a political process that needs to be sustained perhaps for other reasons, but you need periodically to show that you've accomplished something in order to maintain the political support you need back home to continue the dialogue and the process. Second, from the standpoint of the business community, which I'm currently representing, I guess, deliverables matter. I mean, they've discovered, particularly in China, which is, I guess one could charitably say, not really a rule of law country, that they frequently run into difficulties that need to be addressed through some extraordinary means. And what they discovered with the JCCT, particularly when Wu Yi was the Chinese head of it, and I simply haven't got enough comments on her successor to be able to tell you whether the thing has sustained itself. But what American business discovered was that if you could get an issue on the JCCT's agenda, and they were all WEDI-specific issues, but if you could get one there, and if she paid attention and said, I'll work on that, something happened, and she was clearly capable of doing whatever it is you needed to be done within the Chinese bureaucracy to produce a result, which was not always 100% what the Americans wanted. But what, from the standpoint of the American business community, they came to appreciate the structure because they knew that if they had an intractable problem, particularly one that involved more than a single company but a sectoral problem, that this was a means to get high-level attention within the Chinese government, which they had apparently been unable to get on their own, and it was a means to achieve some kind of progress on the problem. And I think having that kind of avenue is enormously valuable in a relationship for the reasons I said earlier. It sustains business community interest in the relationship. It sustains public support for other pieces of the dialogue, including the SED, and it diffuses, not entirely, obviously, but it diffuses some of the congressional pressures for more arbitrary action.
I think, and can I just add something to that, because it's directly sort of two-finger add on to that, which is that it can also help address some of the longer-term sort of structural issues in some cases, not always. Sometimes these things are one-off. But I'm looking at Lou Cohen over here and thinking about Japan and SII, which there are about now two of us in the room who actually remember and would defend SII as an approach. But I would say that it linked the macro and the micro, but I was going to specifically cite the example of the company that Lou used to work for, Toys R Us, which became the sort of poster child of a broader structural issue that we were trying to deal with in Japan, which was the lack of large scale stores, retail stores in Japan, which we saw Treasury doing, you know, this original analysis and defining the problem as an obstacle to greater consumption in Japan because these larger stores tended to, increase consumption. And we originally looked at that as a sort of structural issue. Toys R Us came along and said, well, we want a large store in Japan, and we ended up fighting for that, succeeding. I don't know how Toys R Us is doing now, but I think that this change actually contributed. It helped them in the short term, but it also contributed to a longer-term structural change in Japan that has had value to this day. So that's maybe a partly answer to your question as well as to how you kind of get to the long term from the short term.
We'll go with one more question. But I think one of the issues in terms of tangible achievements, part of it is defining what you want to achieve and managing the marketplace, the political marketplace, to make sure that there are realistic expectations. If the goal, and it is for many people on Capitol Hill or in the business community of these dialogues, is to reduce imports from China in such a way that jobs in the manufacturing sector are created in Ohio, that's completely the wrong dynamic. And in some cases, you actually do need to talk to constituencies and say, well, you know, this may not have anything to do with the loss of manufacturing jobs in the United States. It's something that, unfortunately, for whatever reason, administrations don't like to have. That conversation is not something they like to have. There's an assumption that the trade relationship with China is somehow directly correlated with the loss of manufacturing jobs in the United States. It really isn't. And there are studies on both sides, but the realistic studies that are out there will show pretty categorically that the manufacturing job loss as a result to China as a result of the trade relationship is pretty small, if at all, and it is dwarfed by the economic benefits. So again, you have to manage expectations, and if the administration is not willing to have an honest conversation with those people that believe that is what the deliverable should be, you're really setting yourself for not only disappointing them, but for actually cratering a lot of the benefits that you'd get through the relationship. So the one more question.
Thank you, and thank you all. It's been a really great discussion. I'm Joanne Thornton. I'm with Stanford Group Company. I think this is on, yeah. And I just wanted to ask, all of you have been involved in this policymaking long enough to have worked during periods when there are different balances of power between the two political parties in the Congress and the administration. And it looks like there's a reasonable chance, anyway, that we, after this coming election, will have the same party in both institutions. And I'm just wondering, does that make a difference in managing expectations in the consultative process? Would that be a fortuitous thing or not necessarily so? Thanks.
Well, your lips to God's ears. No, I think not. First of all, we've had several periods where that was so, including in the current administration, and I don't think that it had a huge appreciable difference. I would say as a longtime Democrat, it's also axiomatic that the more Democrats there are, the less they agree amongst themselves. And so I think if the mere fact that they might have a larger majority in the Congress really doesn't mean that they'll be cohesive. They'll probably be less cohesive. I mean, that's a unkind thing to say, but if you look back, particularly in the House, that is generally what happens. When you have to scrape and beg and grovel for every vote, you can build a cohesive caucus, which is why the Republicans over 40 years of being in the minority became a lot more cohesive than Democrats were. When you've got 40 or 50 seats, you can lose 25 and not notice, and over time, pretty soon, you've got groups that are simply gone all the time, and it makes the process a lot more complicated. So I wouldn't assume that it would make a huge difference. It'll make the problems different, but the problems will still be there. And the idea that we're just, that either party in controlling all both houses of Congress, the administration can just, sweep through and work its will, I think is it just doesn't happen.
I want to thank everybody for coming on a very blustery day. Appreciate your coming out, and thanks for I want to thank fellow panelists, and I won't thank each of them, but if you look in the booklet on the members of the task force, some of them are here. I won't recognize you all, Eric and Jim in the back, but Peter was here earlier. Lou is here. Thanks, everybody, for being part of this. Appreciate it.